This week, Ron Pattinson joins me to discuss the history of Scottish ales. This is Beersmith Podcast number 133.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 133, and it's early September 2016. Ron Pattinson joins me to discuss his extensive research into the history of Scottish ales. I'm pleased to announce the Beersmith 2.3 desktop was just released. It's a free update for all 2.x owners, and you can get it from the main download page at beersmith.com. I've been doing a series of posts about the new features, which you can find at the blog at beersmith.com/blog. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running an amazing deal right now, only $19.99 for a year-long subscription, or $17.99 for their digital edition. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers, and I've started running a question and answer column for them as well. Take advantage of the special deal now at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also Anvil, a new line of affordable brewing equipment from Blickman Engineering. This week, we're highlighting Anvil's Ferment in the Kettle kit that converts your Anvil kettle into a fermenter. It comes with a silicone lid seal for the perfect fit. You can use your dip tube as a sediment-free racking cane. Ferment and brew in a single vessel with Anvil. Learn more about Anvil at anvilbrewing.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. This week, my guest is Ron Pattinson, who is an expert on historical beer brewing. He runs a very popular blog on historical brewing at barclayperkins.blogspot.com, where he posts regularly about Scottish and English brewing history. Ron, it is fantastic to have you back on the show. I think this is your second time, right?
Yeah, it's the second time. That was fun last time. So I always like talking about beer, especially with people who want to listen to me talk. I have enough problem with the family, and they're not that keen on hearing all this crap about historic brewing. So it's nice to have an audience that actually wants to hear what I have to say.
And that's the title of your blog, right? Shut Up About Barclay Perkins.
Yeah, that's exactly where that comes
from.
Wasn't
that your son, I think? I'm trying to remember the story.
It's the whole of the family. not just one of them. It's both sons.
None of them want to hear about it, huh?
No.
Well, you've become quite the world expert in historical beer brewing here, from what I recall, right? I see your name everywhere these days.
Yeah. Well, I seem to have got my name out there. I think it's partly after I had the Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer published, and then did quite a lot of promotion for it in the US. So I think that got my name out there a fair bit, and I've been writing a lot of magazine articles as well. So, actually, people seem to be finding out about me.
I don't have it here. I've got your blog right here. Shut Up About Barclay Perkins. Sorry about that. And I'm in the middle of. Let's see. I'll pull up your book in just a minute. But today you wanted to talk a little bit about the history of Scottish beer, which turns out to be quite a bit more complicated than we thought, right?
Yeah, well, Scottish beer, it's an interesting topic because there's been lots spoken about it, most of which seems to be just completely made up just by people's wildly romantic notions of Scotland and what it was. So sort of like this thought that Scotland is nothing but the Highlands and that this big industrial bit in the middle didn't exist. And so people think of Scotland as this wild, windswept, wintry place in Northern Europe. And that's influenced their thinking about Scottish beer, but it's not based in the reality of Scottish beer was really like. And the reality of Scottish beer was it was almost all brewed in the lowlands, in the big population centres and later big industrial centres of Scotland. And there was nothing at all romantic about it. It was quite a big business. And then, of course, the Scottish brewers made a whole load of money selling their beer around the British Empire. I mean, that's one of the things you see with Scottish brewing, that before the Act of Union, Scottish brewing is a real, real backwater. They're hardly brewing anything. It's just this probably dubious quality beer. And then after the Act of Union in 1715, then what you see happens is that you get English porter coming into Scotland. And at first, the Scots are really resentful about this because they don't like this foreign beer coming in. There's this great quote for someone saying about people throwing their money away south of the Tweed by buying English beer. But the English brewing has an influence on Scottish brewing, and it makes them improve their act, basically. But it also gives them possibilities. So it's a two-way thing. So it's not just the fact that now English beer can come into Scotland. It's the fact that it's much easier for Scottish beer to go into England. And that is a huge thing for the Scottish brewers because they've got a relatively small local market. Even a city like Edinburgh in the 17th century, in the 18th century, wasn't that big.
Are you saying the city wasn't big or the brewing wasn't big?
The city wasn't big. They didn't have a big local population. Whereas in London, there are over a million people already. So for Scots, suddenly having access to that London market, that was a huge number of people. It's probably more people than lived in the whole of Scotland at the time. So it seems to have pepped up Scottish brewing. And you see that during the 18th century, the reputation of Scottish beer goes up. They start to get a name for brewing strong beers, probably because that's what they send down to England. And Edinburgh ale and Scotch ale starts to become a thing in England and something that people value and are prepared to pay money for. And so really, that's the thing that really spurs Scottish brewing on in the early days. It's the Act of Union, even though probably a lot of Scottish nationalists wouldn't like you to hear that. And also, when you have the British Empire, suddenly this gives the Scottish brewers this enormous market. You're talking about an empire that spans the whole world and has hundreds of millions of people living in it. And the Scots brewers were actually very clever at exploiting that. And you see that even though Scotland is only... It's all pretty much always been about the same percentage, about 10% of the UK population. You see that during the 19th century... Scottish brewers were responsible for 25% of the beer exported. In the 20s and 30s, that went up to over 50% of the beer that was exported from the UK. So they were really batting well above their weight when it came to exporting. And this is what made Scottish brewing big. If you look at somewhere like Edinburgh, where at one point it had 20-odd breweries, it could never have sustained that on the local market. They were very, very dependent on shipping beer to other places. And so they were always very forward-looking, the Scots. You can always see that they're trying to find new markets for their beer because they know that they're never going to have that big a home market for it.
Well, let's start at the beginning. I want to talk for a minute about what we call Scottish ale today. You know, what does it look like relative to the BJCP style guide, most of which I think you're going to debunk here in a few minutes. But what does it look like, according to the style guide or according to modern things?
Okay. 60, 70, and 80 shilling. The beers as they were brewed after World War II, and the beers that I knew as the Scottish styles in the 70s are basically just three different strengths of one pale ale recipe. But they confuse it by putting loads of caramel into the 60 shilling so it looks like dark mild. Mm-hmm. And the BJCP ones still haven't got the colour of 60 shilling right. It was always dark. I know, I drank it. I've seen the colour. the colour things for it. It was a dark beer. I always thought it was mild. I didn't realise it was just the lowest gravity.
So that's the medium one, I guess, now? I know they changed the style guide. They don't call them by shilling anymore. But
oh, don't they?
No, the 2015 style guide, they updated it, I think.
Yeah, well, I did get asked about that, and I did send some comments, but I still wasn't very happy about the way light looked. It still wasn't dark enough. And one of the big things I have is that I still think that the people who wrote those style guidelines, not one of them has ever drunk a Scottish brewed 60 shilling. Because they were really difficult to get hold of. I've only ever drunk a couple. They were really, really rare. You had to hunt the things down, and I've drunk them, but I'd be very surprised if any of the people who wrote the style guidelines had ever had one. I don't know if any of them still exist in Scotland, to be honest. I really like the Maclay's one. I thought that was a cracking beer. Even though I find out now it's just exactly, it's basically just a weaker version of the 70 shilling with caramel in it. But I still liked it.
But the style guide basically specifies a pretty malty beer, very low hop rates, right?
And that's probably not far from the mark. If you look at post-World War II Scottish beers, yeah, they were very low. They had very low hop rates and often quite a low degree of attenuation, which would make them seem maltier. I think this is the whole thing about the maltiness of Scottish beers. I think people have got it wrong. They're trying to think, oh, it's some sort of malt or some boiling technique that gets this. No, more so it's the fact that you've got a relatively low level of hopping and a high finishing gravity. It's the interesting thing, when I was looking at the Maclay's beers, they're 60, 70 and 80 shilling. You could say that at various periods, they all had, so you'd have like say 60 shilling at 10.35, 70 shilling at 10.42, 80 shilling at 10.50 something. But they'd all have a very similar finishing gravity. So it meant that the most highly attenuated one was the 80 shilling, the strongest beer. And so you could see that in the weaker beers, they were deliberately keeping the degree of attenuation high, presumably to have a beer that had got a lot of body and a bit of sweetness still in it. It's a recurring theme in the Scottish beers that every time I look at them, I see that they're less well attenuated than their English equivalents. And obviously this is something the Scots like. They liked something that was a fuller, not just a sweeter beer, but a fuller beer in the mouth.
First of all, was beer a popular drink in Scotland as it was in England in the 18th and 19th? I think it wasn't, right?
I think in the 18th century, I think not so much so. One of the things that tell me that it wasn't as popular is there's not as much domestic brewing. So in England, pretty much any household of any size in the countryside, and even just ordinary labourers, would brew their own beer. And that was on a much smaller scale in Scotland. Even though you still have one of the classic country house breweries there, Tracair House, it was nothing like as common as it was in England, where everyone brewed in the countryside at one point. And it went on quite a long time, even through into the second half of the 19th century. So that tells me beer wasn't as much a part of daily life in Scotland as it was in England. When you go back before the 18th century. And then you see, again, after the Act of Union, it seems to me that beer becomes more popular, probably partly because you've got better quality beer coming in from England, and it becomes a classier drink. So you get the mass-produced porter coming up from London, which is a very reliable drink. They're brewing it in the enormous quantities. They can brew it the same every single time. And so people think, my guess is that it raised the status of beer in the 18th century. And then you say by the 19th century, the Scots are drinking as much beer as the English are.
And you had some articles showing that, for example, a lot of the average working people didn't really drink that much, right?
In certain periods.
At least initially, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also always been some a high amount of, how can I put this, religious objection to alcohol in Scotland, especially, certainly in the 19th century. And so, I mean, there were dry areas of Glasgow, so they had places in Scotland where you couldn't get alcohol in the 20th century. A bit like down in the southern states of the US, which is something you've never had in England.
Interesting. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
But yeah, I mean, by the 19th century, middle of the 19th century, basically the Scots were drinking this beer the same way as the English were. It's just that it was mostly brewed in big commercial breweries. You didn't really have pub brewing. You didn't really have people brewing at home, which in England went on. In some areas, home brewing was really strong, even through into the 1930s. So in Scotland, it's quite different. It's mostly a thing that people don't do themselves. It's something that someone else does. Whereas in England, it often wasn't like that.
And you studied, I believe, the structure of the beer industry there too, and it was much different than it was in England, right? You didn't have, for example, the pubs owned by the breweries typically.
No, I mean, they had tied estates, but they had relatively small tied estates. So whereas even back in the 18th century, the London brewers had been securing accounts by various means, so not necessarily always owned. But then again, in Scotland, it was a different system. In Scotland, they had a system that's more like what they have here in Holland, which is a loan tie. So I found out various, really, if you look through the book, you'll find some, my Scotland book, you'll find some really interesting examples of this about publicans, the way it used to work, which was that the publican would take a loan from the brewer to do, I don't know, God knows what with his pub. And then he'd agree to just take the beer from that brewery. But it was not a long-term agreement. And so what you often see is that after a while, the publican would cancel that loan with one brewer, get his beer from someone else, who would just pay off his loan with the other brewer. And so then he transferred it to a different brewer. And so that's the way it worked in Scotland. It was done through loan ties. So even though they didn't own the pubs, they still actually controlled a lot of the trade. It was just done in a more subtle way. And this is partly because the licensing authorities are a bit different in Scotland, and they wanted just some individual responsible for each pub and weren't very easy with the idea of breweries owning lots of pubs. And so they controlled them in a different way.
Interesting. Well, you did an extensive comparison going all the way back, I think, to the 1830s between English and Scottish beers. What are some of the things that you found, and how did it sort of evolve over time, too?
Now I'm going to have to try hard to remember all of this because it's really, really complicated, like everything else. So before I start, I'm going to pour myself another beer because that's I'm going to need this to go through this. Just excuse me, sir.
But I mean, it's interesting. The beer, first of all, the beer changed over time. And second of all, the methods changed quite a bit over time. And they were quite a bit different in some cases from the English styles, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like everything. Everything evolves over time. And the one thing I keep saying to people, this idea that the past is this one fixed thing is very untrue. And it's just like the present. So if you think about how much the world's changed in the time that you've been alive and you've been drinking, well, it's been like that in the past. And sometimes there's been even more extreme change because there's been more extreme events going on. I was looking, when I did all the analysis, I was looking at the classic things that people say about the difference between English and Scottish ales, which is to say that the Scottish ones are fermented like lager temperatures, that they are fermented for a really long length of time, that they're really lightly hopped, and that the Scottish brewers have really long boil times. And what I found was that all those things probably were true at one point, but not all at the same time. And so you see that in the earlier part of the 20th century, 19th century, sorry, Scottish beers were boiled for incredibly short times often. So some of the strong ales, it's like only 45 minutes, which is really, really short. I've never seen an English beer boiled for such a short time. I mean, I've seen the reasons why that they did that. Because at a certain period, Scotch ales were prized for being very, very pale in colour. And so they wouldn't want to boil it for too long because they wouldn't want the wort to start darkening. And then you see some other periods towards the end of the 19th century when they do boil them for long periods. And then again in the 20th century, it goes down to being quite short again, or just like the English ones. So it's all over the place, all over time. The one thing I would say that is a recurring feature of one definite difference pretty much all the time between Scottish and English beer is lower degree of attenuation in Scottish beer. So you see that it's always like, rarely do they match up. Sometimes the only times it matches up are in when they're trying to brew English styles for the first time. So if you see their first attempts at brewing porter and stout, or the early attempts at it, you can see that they're the brewing techniques are actually quite different from the other beers they're making. They're obviously trying to do it the London way. And so you'll see that their porters and stouts are coming out at 75% attenuation, when their other beers are mostly 60% at most. And so they're obviously deliberately doing something different with those because they wanted to make them like the London beers. And then, of course, what happens as time goes on, they start adapting those beers to Scottish tastes, and then you see the rate of attenuation going down. But not that much. So even in the early 20th century, some of the William Younger's stouts were still 75% attenuated. And of course, then the Scottish stouts just go weird in the 20th century, and they go down to like 50%, 45% attenuation sometimes.
How do they achieve that low attenuation or lower attenuation than the English beers?
I'm not sure, because it doesn't look like they mashed any differently. I think they just stopped the fermentation. I mean, you have to realize that people have this idea that they didn't have control over fermentation because they didn't have refrigeration in the past. But all the brewers, they all had attemperators, all these pipes that went through the fermenters that had cold water going through. So they could control the temperature of the fermenters fairly accurately, even in the late 18th century. And so my guess
even
is
even though they didn't have a thermometer at that point, right?
No, they did have thermometers. They all came in at the same time. Okay. So my guess is they were cold crashing them. And you can see in the fermentation record, you can see they dropped the temperature down at the end of it.
Interesting. So they were actually halting the fermentation, huh?
I think so, yeah. And it could also have been possibly to do with the yeast strains as well, because the way Scottish brewers work, it's really weird. They're always using each other's yeasts. So my guess is they only actually had one type of yeast in Edinburgh, because they swapped it around between each other so much that they probably didn't really have proprietary yeast anymore. I would guess partly that, a low fermenting yeast. Also, I know people have been telling me, because they've been playing around with Chevalier malt recently, that you don't get as good attenuation out of it. And that would explain why a lot of English beers, you know, in the 19th century, their attenuation doesn't look great. It's like 68, 70%, a lot of them. The classy ones, the pale ales, those ones they can get much better attenuation on. And the Scottish ones is less, but I guess by a combination of how they fermented it and, I don't know, and just generally lower rates of attenuation then. But it's still better than lagers. You should say lagers. The early lagers are rubbish. 19th century lagers, most of them are only about 65% attenuation. You look at the Salvata, the classic Doppelbock. I mean, the early ones are those that are like 50% attenuated. So you've got these things that have got this huge original gravity, and they're only 5% alcohol.
That's very interesting. You mentioned
that. Digressing, aren't I?
Yeah. You mentioned that though we associate Scotland with strong beer, it's actually the weaker small beer or table beer that was widely consumed, right? At least in Scotland, yeah.
Right. This is something where you have to talk about periods. And so if you look at the, say, the early 19th century, you've got the Scots are brewing all sorts of strengths of beers. And there's quite a lot of table beer, but also quite a lot of strong beer. So it's really a mixture. But you see, as you go later on, the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, then you've got Scottish beers which are way weaker than anything you'd get in England. So you've got beers which are under 1040, which you didn't really get in England at that time. And it's great because the statistics on the average OG of beers brewed in the different parts of the United Kingdom. And you can see 1900 to 1914 in Scotland, it starts to really diverge from England. And so by the time of the outbreak of World War I, the average OG of beer brewed in Scotland is about 10% lower than in England. And that's at a time when the Scots are exporting quite a lot of really strong beer. So you have to guess that, yeah, the stuff that was being drunk domestically, a lot of it was quite weak. And I can see in the brewing records, they're brewing a lot of the stuff that isn't that strong. And I'd think I'd be shocked to see in a London brewer to brew a beer of that strength at that time.
We also associate Scottish ales with low hop rates and maltiness, of course. But the historical record seems to indicate that there were a lot of hoppy beers brewed as well, right?
Yeah, well, loads. I mean, look, the Scots were big exporters of IPA in the mid-19th century. And they could not have not been hoppy beers. So, I mean, I've looked at William Younger's IPAs from the 1850s, and they got like 8 pounds of hops a barrel, which is a lot. It's a lot, and it's exactly the same.
That is a lot.
Yeah, and that's the same sort of amount as you've got in English IPAs. It's really crazy levels of hopping. And then because I'm working on a book at the moment. Well, I'm working on a load of Scottish recipes at the moment, so I've been intimately connected with some Scottish practices recently. And the dry hopping rates are really crazy on some of the beers. So you're looking at beers that are getting a pound of dry hops per barrel, which is a lot, I think. And even some of the not that strong milds are getting like a quarter or half a pound of dry hops. So it's quite odd. I've seen some beers where there's almost as many hops used as dry hops as there are as kettle hops in a brew, which is pretty crazy. So it's really hard to generalize about the Scots and the way they use hops because it varies so much. And I've seen some of the strong ales as well. Again, in the 19th century, if you look at the top end of the shilling ales, so the 120, 140, 160 shilling ales, they are hopped like mad. They've got the same sort of level of hops as the IPAs in them. So 8-9 pounds a barrel. So really large amounts. It's really hard to generalize about Scottish brewing. This is one of the things that it's not this one thing that's been set in stone at a certain point. It's evolved and changed and been complex and contradictory at certain times as well, because not all the brewers did the same thing. I mean, I realize that I initially looked mostly at William Younger's records, and the more other Scottish brewers I've looked at, the more I've realized that they were actually quite weird and they didn't brew the way most of the other ones did. So it's like everything. It's very, very complex when you start looking at it in detail.
Well, I believe hops were not widely grown in Scotland and had to be imported. What varieties were popular, and where did they get most of their hops?
Well, they got them from everywhere. I'm only talking 1800s onwards. I don't like to go back into the dark ages too much. In the 18th century, I know they grew hops in Scotland. They weren't brewing a huge amount of beer, so they probably didn't need that many hops. And they could presumably have got them from England quite easily because they did trade. I mean, this is one of the things about William Younger, that they used to ship beer down to London by boat and then bring back Kent hops on the way back, which is a very clever way to work.
Makes sense.
But they got them. Yeah, it does make sense. But they got hops from all over. But when you're talking 19th century, this is typical of everywhere in Britain. The London brewers, Britain couldn't grow enough hops. So everywhere was dependent on foreign hops. It wasn't just Scotland. Everywhere was dependent on foreign hops. And so the records I've been looking at recently, I've seen lots of Sars, lots of Hallertau. So Sars, William Younger's loved those. So 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, they're using lots of Sars hops. They're using generally a combination of Sars, North American hops, and Kent hops. I mean, interestingly, I've seen William Younger's logs where they because they normally do things by, it's odd, they normally just say where they come from rather than variety. But they'll say specifically Sars and specifically Hallertau. But the American ones, they'll say sometimes American and sometimes Californian. Obviously, they're making a distinction between East and West Coast hops, I think. Because originally, all the hops that came into the UK from the US were grown on the East Coast, obviously New York mostly. And then
it just so happens one of my great-great-grandparents grew hops in central New York, actually.
Yeah, well, New York was a huge, huge hop region. And a big part of their business was shipping hops to England, because that's where they could make the money out of them. And so it's this weird symbiotic relationship you see grows up between the British brewers and the American hop industry in the late 19th century, where farmers in the US are encouraged to grow hops because they know they can sell them to the UK and get quite good money for them. And it's worth their while to grow them as a cash crop. And if it had just been dependent on the American industry, you'd never have had such a large hop industry in New York, because there wasn't the demand in the US at the time for that quantity of hops.
Yep. One of my great-great-grandfathers was actually a hop grower in central New York. Kind of interesting.
I see they've started doing it again as well, haven't they, growing hops up there?
They have. They've started growing hops and malt all across the Northeast again. And it's kind of interesting. It's a lot of really small growers, but it's starting to take off again.
Well, I know the people at Valley Malts in Massachusetts are really lovely people. Well, talking about hops, my wife, just before we started this, came back with a bag of wild hops she'd just harvested here in Amsterdam, if you can believe that.
That's awesome. Yeah, a lot of the hops in New York were wiped out, I think, by disease originally, but now they're coming back. Yeah, now we have ways to control that, obviously.
Yeah, well, I think it was disease, and that's the main reason they shipped it, went west, because they didn't have particularly the mildew. Yeah. Which is it's the big killer for hops, but these wild ones look wonderful. I'm amazed they can grow that wild and in the center of Amsterdam, basically,
which is where you are, of course. Barley and its variants were grown and malted in Scotland quite a bit, right? And there was I understand there's a popular variety of barley called Big. What is that?
Big. It's sometimes called four row, sometimes called six row. It's seems to basically be a primitive sort of barley. So probably a precursor to modern barley, which grows in worse climates than barley will. And so it was popular in Scotland. I think it might have come originally from Norway. I'm not sure. But it's basically something that will grow better in northern climates. And I looked up some stuff about this, and one of the weird things about Big is that when you use it in brewing, this is according to one source, and I don't know if this is true, when you use it in brewing, it's not as good as barley, but if you use it for making malt whiskey, it's actually quite good, and that's probably one of the reasons they grew it. But I've seen brewing records that have Big in, and it says Big, some of the early William Younger's ones. But I think what happened is that as transport got better and Scottish brewers had more access to English grain, then you see what they start doing. Rather than using the sort of marginally grown Big, which would be grown further north in Scotland, because in the sort of central part of Scotland, you can grow normal barley. So a lot of the barley that the Edinburgh brewers would have used would have been grown quite locally. But what you also see is they start bringing in grain from East Anglia, where they can grow, which has probably the best climate for growing grain in the UK. And they were bringing that up by boat up to Scotland and malting that. And so at some point, Scottish brewers completely stopped using local grain, and they were just using English grain because it was better quality. So you see that Big dies out basically just because it's from competition, I think, from better quality barley. And if there isn't a price difference, why the hell should you use something that's not quite as good?
We also associate with peat flavors and aroma with Scottish ales, but you've done quite a bit of research on that too, right? What'd you find?
Where can I start
that smoked peat flavor? But you've got pretty strong opinions on it, I think.
Okay, right. The Scottish breweries were virtually all located in the central part of Scotland, the lowlands, basically, where there's no peat, but you've got loads of coal. So why the hell would they ship in peat to cure their malt with when they wouldn't have wanted a smoky flavor anyway? And they got loads of coke made from locally mined coal to use in their kilns instead.
In fact, not shockingly, I think most of the breweries were located in the coal country where the workers were drinking it, right? Drinking the beer.
Exactly. it's not just why they were, but it's partly why they were there. That's where everyone lived, and that's also where all the ports were. It's going back to this romantic idea that people have of Scotland, you know? So it's like the Highlands with the peat bogs and everything. And no, that's not what Scottish brewing was like. It was in big industrial towns, and they weren't going to use peat to smoke their malt. And they wouldn't have wanted that flavor in there anyway. But it's the power of suggestion, partly, right? Yeah. I brewed a William Younger recipe from 1949, number one, which is the top of the range Scotch ale from them, mm-hmm. With Pretty Things. I'll look at the reviews on Rate Beer. There's people who say tasting notes. Several people say peat. There's no peat in there. Not even light peat. There's not even any dark malt in it. It's corn grits, pale malt, lactose, and caramel. That's all that's in it. And people were saying that they could taste peat in it. So it's a power of suggestion. People think it's Scottish. It must taste of peat. Now, I'm sure it comes up completely from the malt whiskey stuff. I mean, personally, I really, really, really love the Islay peated malt whiskies. But it's got nothing to do with Scottish beer.
So no peat in your Scottish beer then, right?
No, of course. They wouldn't have wanted that in there. If they tried making beer with peated malt, that their customers would have spat the beer out. But they wouldn't have drunk it. It's not what they expected.
Well, we've already touched on this a little bit, but the historical record shows a wide variety of beers were actually brewed in Scotland, of course, from Scotch Twopenny to Edinburgh Ale to, you know, a whole bunch of other different kinds that probably don't fit neatly into the current styles. What were some of these beers like, or what do you think they were like?
Okay, Scottish Twopenny. There's a whole load of crap about Scottish Twopenny and the Oxford Companion to Beer, which is all completely made up. Scottish Twopenny was a tax category. I'm going to go back to the Act of Union again. And in the Act of Union, as a concession to the Scots, they gave them this special tax category for a sort of beer that they drank there. So if you look at what it was sort of like halfway. It wasn't table beer, but it wasn't strong beer. So it was like you're looking at something that was probably about 10.45 in gravity. So probably about, Scotch attenuation, probably about 3% alcohol. So a fairly low gravity beer, just a simple drinking beer. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason it's called Twopenny is because of how much it cost and how much it cost a pint. It being confusing because it was what it cost a Scottish pint rather than what it cost an English pint. A Scottish pint, strangely enough, being the equivalent of 4 English pints.
So a Scottish pint is 4 English pints?
It was, yeah.
So that's 80 ounces of beer, is that right?
Yeah, well, 80 imperial ounces, yeah. Well, it would have been, this is going back a bit, so it would be slightly different because the size of a pint changed in 1829 when, I'm not going to go into this, it's way too much detail.
But it's a lot of pints, three or four typical pints, right?
Yeah, but you have to bear that in mind in working out how strong it was, is how much that cost. It was, because it was for a Scottish pint.
So what about some of the others? What about Edinburgh Ale or some of the other popular styles?
Well, Edinburgh Ale, that's really shilling ales, what I would call them. So the sort of strong Scottish mild ales, basically. I spent ages looking into this, trying to work out what the hell Scottish ales were. So Scotch Ale and Edinburgh Ale. And when I looked at the brewing records, it became obvious what they were. They were just very strong mild ales. I mean, the top end. So mild ales of, you know, 1090, 1100, or even stronger, I mean, 1130. So really quite strong ales, but still mild ales in that they weren't beers that were meant to be aged for any length of time. They were things that were sold relatively young. So that's one of the reasons why they wouldn't be hugely hoppy. Because in the 19th century and 18th century, people used hops mostly as a preservative. So the level of hopping wasn't a question of flavor often. It was a question of how long you wanted the beer to keep. So if it was going to be sold mild, then you didn't need to use as many hops in there because it didn't need to have as many. And if you put loads of hops in it when it was young and it wasn't aged properly, then it'd have this really harsh hoppy flavor that people didn't like. So obviously you'd be hopping it less.
If you're brewing over 100, you said the original gravity is well over 100, it'd be more like a barley wine, right? Except it wouldn't have been aged.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what...
It'd be like a young barley wine, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be basically what it's like. I mean, William Youngers, they were crazy. There's some periods where they had like four or five different beers that were all over 1100.
Wow. That's pretty heavy.
Yeah. I mean, and the top ones were like 1130, 1140. So really about as far as you can go.
That's a lot of malt. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of malt. And presumably that's why they got a reputation for malty beers, just because some of the beers they brewed were incredibly strong. And
they probably didn't achieve very good attenuation there either, because the yeast probably had a low tolerance, right? I mean, probably couldn't even tolerate that high alcohol environment, well, I would think.
Well, no, the alcohol didn't get that bad because they'd have a finishing gravity of, I don't know, 1040.
Right, because, same thing I was just saying, the yeast probably couldn't finish it, really.
Yeah.
didn't have the tolerance. Yeah. You touched on this a minute ago, but what role did government and taxation play in the evolution of Scottish brewing?
Well, a huge one, because it, with all British beer, it had a huge impact because it discouraged people from brewing stronger beers. And that's why you see the gravities in British beers collapse in the 20th century, just because the tax was so high. And so it's always had an effect, you know. I mean, on Scottish brewing, the same way as it would have had on English brewing. So you say, well, in the 19th century, Scotch ales are famous for being these really pale beers brewed from all pale malt. Well, if you go back into the 18th century, that probably wasn't the case. That they probably were brewing some of the beers from darker malts, but when you had all the tax things, the tax on malt, that encouraged people to use less malt, and so everyone went over to all pale malt. So that was a big effect. I guess the fact that they got all the tax back when they exported beer, that was a big incentive for Scottish brewers to export beer to the rest of the empire. And while you also had in Scotland, you had some particularly different things from England. So you had, there was always a much bigger temperance threat in Scotland. So that might explain partly why Scottish beers tended to be weaker in the 20th century, that they didn't want to offend the temperance people too much. or maybe just because the Scots were broke. No, 20s and 30s were very hard times in Scotland.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think there were hard times everywhere, weren't they?
Well, particularly in Scotland.
Yeah. Well, the historical record shows quite a bit of variation from what we see today. You know, the Scottish, how did the Scottish ale style that we see today sort of come into being? How did it evolve? And you know, all these historical styles eventually boil down to what we now associate with Scottish ale.
Okay. The modern Scottish styles have no connection with the old ones whatsoever. They're all basically pale ale.
So there is no tie, huh?
No, not at all.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Edinburgh Ale, for example. It sounds like it's not far, right?
Right. You have the split in the stuff. So you have the Shilling Ales, which are the old mild ales that they brewed in Edinburgh and Scotland. Then you have when pale ale comes in, they start brewing them alongside them, and they start brewing porter and stout as well. Mm-hmm. So you've got the English styles and you've got the Scottish styles. What happens gradually is that the pale ales just completely take over. And so after World War I, the old Shilling ales are completely dead. William Younger, they continue making strong Scotch ales, which is slightly different. So they're an exception. All the other breweries, what they go over to is they just brew. They have a pale ale recipe that they brew to several different strengths, and then they'll do a strong version of it out off the party gale at 1080, and that's their Scotch ale. So it's basically just one recipe, a pale ale recipe, has no connection with the past whatsoever. William Younger's slightly different. They're number one and number three. They don't brew from the pale ale recipe, and the last ones I've got from them in 1949, they're still brewing them as separate recipes and not like their pale ales. But all the other Scottish breweries' records I've seen, it was just a stronger version of their Party Gale pale ale.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to talk for a minute here about some of the things you're doing right now. First of all, I wanted to mention your book, The Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, which
it's a wonderful one.
You published some time ago now, I think it was a couple of years back, right?
2014.
Yep, 2014.
I think, just putting in a little plug here, I think it has the best description of the development of English styles of any book anyone's ever written. Being modest there.
Being modest, yes. It is a good book, and you can get it on Amazon. Ron Pattinson is, of course, the author. Well, I was gonna say, you also mentioned to me earlier that you were heading to Chicago tomorrow, I think, right?
Yeah, tomorrow. I'm off to Chicago tomorrow. Monday, I'm giving one of my little talks about Stock Pale Ale to promote the brewery I'm doing with Goose Island, which is a Stock Pale Ale. 1870s Truman recipe from Burton, aged 11 months in neutral oak, inoculated with Brettanomyces. Just an amazing beer. And one I'd been trying to get someone to brew one of these for ages and ages.
So Goose Island, they brewed it some time ago. Has it been aged already?
Yeah. I mean, this project's been going for 3 years.
So it's going to be available commercially now, or is available commercially?
Yeah, it's going to be available commercially. The launch in the US is next Monday. And
you said Goose Island. What's the name of the beer itself?
It's Goose Island Brewery Yard. And the reason it's called Brewery Yard is the way that the crazy way Bass used to age their pale ale in the 19th century, which is they used to fill it up into barrels and then just stack it up in the brewery yard and leave it out in the open for a year.
Wow, that's incredible.
So I thought that was a good story. And the people at Goose Island think we've thought so as well.
Is that what you did at Goose Island? You just threw it outside for a while?
Well, unfortunately. Probably not, huh? No, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to work in the Chicago climate. No,
that would not be good. Probably have bullet holes in it or something.
Well, yeah. No, I was more thinking about it getting too cold and too hot. But, that wouldn't have worked in Chicago. So it was just inside one of their warehouses. But they took great effort to get the oak neutral. So steaming it, there were barrels that had been used a couple of times before for beer. And then they steam cleaned them really heavily to try and get any trace of anything out of it. So it was just completely neutral, the wood, which is what British brewers went for in the 19th century. I think they did a pretty good job. I couldn't taste any wood or any other flavor in the beer. So, but a beautiful Brettanomyces character. I mean, it smells like Orval.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm hoping to get a couple bottles of that myself. Well, Ron, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. I want to mention also your blog.
One thing I wanted to mention is I'm planning another one of my tours through the US in April next year in the Midwest. And I'm going to have a Scottish theme to this. So I want to get homebrew clubs involved. I'll give them Scottish recipes. They can brew them up, and then I'll come along and talk about Scottish brewing, and we can drink the beer and have general fun.
Well, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to that as well. But yeah, I did want to mention you have a blog here at Shut Up About Barclay Perkins, and it's, let me see if I can get this right. It's barclayperkins.blogspot.com is the actual web address there. And you have, I think, you sent me, I think, probably over 100 articles on Scottish brewing there, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I've got loads more than that.
I was going to say maybe several hundred articles on Scottish brewing
there. Yeah, it's quite crazy. I mean, my book, Scotland, has now got too big. I can't publish the latest version on Lulu because it's got too many pages. It's got up to 840.
That's amazing. You've written a lot of articles on Scottish brewing.
Yeah, it's one of my many obsessions. But I always think, yeah, if you can't have obsessions, what's the point in living?
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you again, Ron, for coming on the show. It's been great having you. Really appreciate it.
Okay, it's always fun. One thing I wanted to say, actually.
Yeah, go ahead, please. I'm sorry. I didn't ask. Is there anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, no. But one thing I really want to add is, you know, in... Because I use Beersmith, right?
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that are annoying, which is you don't have the numbered invert sugars in there.
The number of what? I'm sorry?
No, the invert sugars, the numbered English invert sugars, 1, 2, 3, and 4.
You can add those pretty easily. You just go to the grain section and add them if you want.
I can add them myself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ingredients, grain, yeah. I'd be happy to show you.
I'm just not using the software properly, am I?
That's okay. There's a lot of... It's hard for me to add every ingredient. We've got add-ons and stuff. But yeah, it's... you have the flexibility, obviously, add your own ingredients and use those. Oh, okay. So.
No, that's good. No, I mean, normally I just put invert sugar in and change the SRM on it. But
well, that's okay, too. Yeah, that works fine, too.
I can do that and just put it in as an ingredient. Oh, yeah.
You can. You can go add your own, yeah.
I should have got my son to look at this for me because he could probably have worked it out better.
I'll help you after the show. But Ron, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, it's been fun.
Always a pleasure. Coming from the Netherlands today, I'm on the East Coast, but you're in Amsterdam, I think, right?
Yeah, I'm in Amsterdam. It's sunny Amsterdam for once.
He's coming from sunny Amsterdam. We had the one and only Ron Pattinson as our guest today. You can find his blog, which is Shut Up About Barclay Perkins. And also his book, The Homebrewer's Guide to Vintage Beer, on Amazon. Thank you again, Ron. Appreciate you being here.
Okay, bye.
Well, a big thank you to Ron Pattinson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. This month features hoppy and mixed fermentation lagers. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get a one-year subscription now for only $19.99 from beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also Anvil, an amazing line of affordable brewing equipment from Blickman Engineering. Get the Ferment in a Kettle kit that lets your Anvil kettle be used as a fermenter. You can see the full line of Anvil equipment at anvilbrewing.com. Again, that's anvilbrewing.com. And finally, a quick reminder to grab the new Beersmith 2.3 update. The world's best beer brewing software just got better, packed with new features like pH adjustment, simplified recipe editing, and more. You can download it from beersmith.com or read about all the features on my blog at beersmith.com/blog. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.